The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. As I look around, I'm pleased to tell you that the State of Our Union is... Wait, that's someone else's speech. I was afraid that might happen. Like the president, our guest this evening seems to be coming at us from every angle. Turn on the TV, and you're likely to see him solving mysteries involving codes and cabals in his new History Channel show, Decoded. If you sort through your kid's backpack, you'll probably find a copy of his latest Eisner Award-winning Justice League or Buffy the Vampire Slayer comic book. And I can already tell you that if you open the New York Times Book Review this Sunday, or you go to your local bookstore or library, you'll find that the number one best-selling work of fiction in the country is The Inner Circle by our guest this evening. Please welcome Brad Meltzer.
So here is the best quote that I heard today in the green room on the 10 show, and this speaks of completely Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, as someone went, State of the Union, that sucks, no glee tonight. And I was just like, yes, this is where it is, the founding of our nation, here it is, no glee tonight. So I was like, actually, State of the Union sucks, we're going to lose all the political people tonight. So I appreciate anyone who voted for us over Obama. I appreciate that. It means more than you know. This is obviously an honor to be here tonight, and I just want to thank everyone at the Free Library for putting together an amazing event and putting the word out. It means more than I can express. This is a book, The Inner Circle is a book about history. And to me, it is about my own personal history, and even to my history in this city. This is the first event that I've done downtown since I first came here, and I've had my first novel came out in 1997. I had a full head of hair. It was like a lion's mane that ran backwards. And they had me do an event downtown here, and it was like two people. I was related to both of them. And then I just needed more punishment, so I came back the next book, and we had one person. I was related to that person, too. It was amazing that we lost a relative on that one. But then they always put me out in the suburbs, and they said, oh, you know, there's no one that's going to come out in Philadelphia downtown on a cold night. So thank you for proving that wrong and for so many people joining us here tonight. It means a great deal, as I said. And this book, The Inner Circle, I want to tell you where it started. And as I said, it's about history. So perfect for this city. I got a phone call a couple of years ago from the Department of Homeland Security, and they asked me to come and brainstorm different ways that terrorists could attack the United States. And my first thought was, if they're calling me, we have bigger problems than anybody thinks, right? We're screwed. Like, we are screwed. That was the only thing I could conclude, is we are screwed. But I was honored to be part of what they call the Red Cell Program. And the Red Cell Program would bring together what they call out-of-the-box thinkers. Crazy people, right? That's what they really were saying. And they would pick someone like myself, who's a thriller writer. I guess they saw that I've done a book that took place in the underground tunnels beneath the White House or in the catacombs below the Zero Game. I will tell you that recently, a friend who works in the FBI, I did a book called The Millionaires. And in The Millionaires, it's about hiding from the government and hiding money from the government. And the FBI busts into this guy who's hiding from the government and who's laundering money from the government, and they break into his little lair, which makes him sound like a Batman villain, but they break into the lair. And what book does he have on his desk? The Millionaires. And I'm like, should I ask for that guy, that criminal, for a blurb? Is that a good thing? Like, should I be happy? I don't know whether to be happy or sad about that. But I guess the Department of Homeland Security realized that I do this research and I try to do my best to get it right. And they had me come in. They would pair me with a Secret Service agent, with a chemist. They would give us a target. And we would destroy a major city in a matter of an hour. You know, I would come up with my crazy way inside, and then the Secret Service guy would say, no, this is the far better way where the security is going to be easier to get through. And the chemist would say, no, use this chemical. It'll dissipate less quickly in the air. And as I said, we would destroy a city in an hour. And it's not one of those days you go home feeling good. You go home terrified because you see how easy it is to kill us. And one of the things I was most struck by is the simple fact that they were calling ordinary people like myself. So where does that start? Who comes up with an idea like that? And I traced it back through history to a man named George Washington. And George Washington had his own secret spy ring. And he used to write in invisible ink. And they used to have code names. George Washington's code name was actually 7-Eleven. That's the worst code name of all time, right? 7-Eleven, that's what they came up with. But the thing is, that's actually where 7-Eleven got their name from. I totally made that up just now for you, right? You see what I did? I was just telling you something that was completely real, and then I threw in some fiction, and you guys believed it. You suckers, right? I mean, but that's not what it is. But I will tell you that if I did run 7-Eleven, that would be the new ad campaign. I would be like, 7-Eleven, the founder of the country, and buy a Slurpee. You know, I mean, it would just be, which is why they don't hire me to do marketing for 7-Eleven. But I was fascinated by what George Washington had. And what he did was he said he was so tired of his own military men having their information intercepted that he said, forget the military guys. Give me regular people, regular citizens, because no one will look twice at them. And this guy, George Washington, was smart, right? And the British said about him, George Washington, they didn't outfight us, they outspied us. And he used this Culper ring, was the name of his ring. They, as I said, moved information away from the British. They arguably helped win the Revolutionary War for us, and I just love what they did. So I said to my guy who worked in Homeland Security, I said, wouldn't it be cool if for my next novel, if you found out that George Washington's secret spy ring still exists to this very day? And he says to me, what makes you think it doesn't? I said, what are you talking about? He says, think about it. It's one of George Washington's greatest success stories, and it arguably helps win the Revolutionary War. Why would he ever disband it? And I said, thank you for that idea for my new novel. I will be stealing that from you now. And the truth was, is that's where I got the idea for The Inner Circle. And it was this very simple premise, which is a young archivist at the National Archives realizes that George Washington's spy ring still does exist to this day. He has no idea who they're working for, no idea what they're doing, but the greatest secret of the presidency is about to be revealed. And when I was doing the research, for those who do read the books that I write, I love trying to get that research right. I love trying to figure out the real thing. So I actually said to them, at Homeland Security, the people I was working with, I said, can you help me design a modern-day Culper ring? I didn't want to just make it up. I said, help me design what it would look like today. And they explained things to me, and it was amazing. They said to me, well, if you're the president of the United States, what do you think you need more than anything else? And I said, well, you need smart people. I said, no, that's easy. You're the president. Any smart person is going to want to meet with you. You've got plenty of smart people. I said, someone you can trust. They said, every president brings someone they can trust. You know, Bill Clinton brought Bruce Lindsay. You know, Bush brings his people. Everyone brings their own people. Obama has his own Chicago folks who he trusts. That's easy. And what they explained to me, and you see it in the novel, is that when you're the president, there's a piece of information out in the field. And that piece of information gets taken down. It gets put in a report. The report goes to an analyst. The analyst goes maybe to another military guy or a supervisor, which makes its way up the ladder. Then it goes over to the Pentagon, and it goes to some undersecretary. It goes to maybe a general. By the time it finally gets into the president's briefing book, and these were his words, he said, a piece of information is like a picked over dog bone. And then you as the president of the United States have to take that piece of information and make a decision based on it. And he said, and you, millions of lives are going to be at stake in some cases. Do you really want to bet and wager all those lives on that picked over dog bone? And you know what? That made sense to me. Complete and utter sense, right? And he said, the one thing that every president needs is good information. That's what George Washington realized. And I said, this is great. It's perfect. It is as important as it was to George Washington. It is as important and vital as it is today. And we saw whether it was, you know, looking the reasons why we went into the war in Iraq. I mean, good information changes everything. And man, we could change the world if you had some good information that you could count on. So I knew what the president needed, and then I just needed a president. Now, the good news was, a couple years ago, I got a letter that came from former President George Bush Sr., the dad. And he said, he wrote me a letter that said, I like your novel, The Millionaires. Would you mind signing a copy for me? You know what? You're the former president. I'll send you a free book, right? I'll send you a coloring book. I'll send you a box of 64 crayons. I'll, you know, even the one with your, you know, the little sharpener in the back. You got it. It's on me. Don't worry. And I sent him a book, and I got in a letter also from Clinton a couple years ago, which is nice. And I said to him as I was researching this book, I said, sir, I said, could you tell me, and I said this to Bush, I said, I'm writing a novel, and I want to know, could George Washington's secret spy ring still exist today? And more important, I said, I found out this story. Ronald Reagan, during his last moments in the White House, famously wrote a letter that said, don't let the turkeys get you down. And he drew a picture of a turkey, and he slipped it in the Oval Office desk, and he left it for George Bush. And George Bush, when he left a note for Clinton, and Clinton left a note for George W. Bush, who left a note for Obama. It is the greatest private tradition of the modern presidency. And I said to him, could you actually, sir, move information president to president in those secret letters? And so I wait for the response. The response pops up in my email. And I will tell you, George Bush has the greatest email address. It's not like, you know, America6969@AOL.com. It's close to that, but, you know. But the truth, you know, it pops up. I don't know what it says, but I open it up and it says, the president wants you to have this. I'm like, ooh, what's this? And I click the attachment. And on the attachment, he sent me, George Bush sent me the secret letter that he wrote to Bill Clinton. And my first thought was, oh, my gosh, he sent me a secret code. Right? So I do what we do on Decoded every week. I check to see if it's, you know, the Freemason codes in there. Is it the code that Thomas Jefferson used to use when he was president? I check to see if every third letter of every word spells out, I hate you, Bill. I'm like, what is in this thing, right? There's got to be something in here. And so I'm going through. And I still, you know, if you can crack it, please come help me. I put it on the website so people on Facebook, you can see it. There were no codes in there at all. What it was this completely generous letter, this amazingly generous letter. You know, this was a moment when George Bush had every reason to hate Bill Clinton. And rather than write him, I hate you, Bill, which would not be the best letter to really send, but he could have written anything. He wrote, you know, I'm rooting hard for you, and our success, our country's success is your success. And, you know, talk to him about the critics and the wounds you'll feel and the loneliness that he said he never felt in office that other people complain of. And it was really, it's George Bush attempting a friendship with Bill Clinton. You see it for the first time happening. And it's a moment where he's putting the country above his own personal feelings. And I think especially now where we look where we are in Arizona, and you see, you know, we're a country that everyone's talking about how we talk to each other. I guarantee you the State of the Union tonight is going to be about how we talk to each other. We are a great country at saying what's wrong, right? We all know how to bitch and moan when we say that we don't know how to talk to each other. We don't know how to communicate. Our political discourse is a mess. We are great at saying what's wrong. It's really hard for us to say what's right. And to me, this kind of letter, these two men talking in this civil tone, is exactly what's right in America. It's one of these great little moments of history. And those details are what inform the book, and it helps me develop a real president as opposed to that kind of caricature you tend to see in most thrillers and in any kind of fiction where the president's just this, like, you know, lantern-jawed person who just says, you know, go to the situation room right now, and that's basically the depth of his character. Maybe sometimes he doesn't have right now, and then you know he's a very different kind of president. But the truth is I wanted a real president, and it was helpful to have one to call on and be able to ask these questions. And then the other thing you'll see is the book is set in the National Archives. And when I researched the archives, I was there a couple weeks ago, and they handed me a sheet of paper, a blank white sheet of paper and with pencil markings on it. And it looked like a map, and you could see Maryland, you could see Virginia. And they said, guess who drew this? I said, I have no idea. They said, take a guess. It's an escape route. I said, I don't know. They said, John Wilkes Booth. And that's a pretty cool thing that they have, and they have great, amazing documents. You know, I said, can I have it? They're like, no, you can't have it. I'm like, can I sign my name on the Declaration of Independence? They're like, no, you cannot sign your name on the Declaration of Independence, which I did, right under John Hancock. You'll see it now. Dick Penn, Brad Meltzer, put a little swirl at the bottom. But they have these amazing documents, and I said, how do you store all these things? How do you take care of them? And they explained to me that the storage of documents has very little to do with space. Space is easy. There's a lot of space in America. The issue with storing documents is temperature. How do you keep them cool so that they're not deteriorating? And what they explained to me is, they said, oh, yeah, we have underground caves all across the country, and that's where we store it. I'm like, wait, okay. You have secret underground caves? The National Archives have secret underground caves all across the United States? I would like to go to those caves now, please. Take me to those caves. I'm like, let's go. You got secret? You got a bat cave? Let's go. And we go. They actually took me, and this is the greatest place to talk about it, at the Boyers, Pennsylvania. There's one right here. And in Boyers, Pennsylvania, for those who go there, there are great old mines up there, and all the mines have been picked clean of the limestone. And so what they did is they turned the caves into storage for our government. And you'll see Iron Mountain up there, and there's lots of stuff stored there, not just from our government. And when we went into the caves, and it really does look like the Batcave. It's not cleaned out and, you know, fancy. It's a cave. And we're walking, and I can see metal doors built into the cave walls. And flags hanging down above the doors that say, you know, the Army, the Navy, the Air Force. And as we're walking, I said, you know, it's amazing that they let us see who's storing stuff in this cave. And they said, no, those are the doors they want you to see. You wouldn't believe who else is in this cave with us. I would like to go to the back of the cave now, please. Right? And so we go, and as we're walking, you can see that there's a net on the ceiling. It looks like a net that you would throw overboard, you know, when you're on a boat and they're catching fish. I said, what's the net for up top? And they said, oh, that's to keep the cave from crashing in on our heads. What the hell are we doing in this cave? Get us out of here right now. Are we kidding? A net? That's what you use to protect our lives? And, you know, not steel, not anything. But I loved being in that cave. And what you see in the last 100 pages of The Inner Circle, I won't ruin the end of the book, but the scene takes place in those underground caves here in Pennsylvania. And what you see is real. It's exactly as I saw it. I dressed up the archives room a little bit because they were under construction and transition at that moment. But what you see in the very back of the cave when you go, that's not real. It's real too, right down to the little swinging doggy door that you'll see back there. But it was amazing. And to me, that drives the fiction. I think that I can make up whatever I want, right? And I can put an axe in someone's head and try and scare you with blood and, you know, violence. And to me, that's just gratuitous. I don't do gratuitous violence. That's not what I do in my books. Because to me, you know what's scary? What's scary is when you have something that can really happen. And what's scary to me is when you walk into a closed bathroom and you hear a noise in the dark on the opposite side of the closed shower curtain, which guarantees right now that when all of you go to the bathroom tonight, you will be thinking of me, right? I will be there with you. But that to me is what's scary, because it can happen, right? Think of me when you're in your bathroom tonight. I promise you right now, you'll not. It's like pink elephants. I'm going to be there. You're going to be like, stupid Meltzer in the bathroom with me. I think that's pretty much the proudest thing I'm going to do tonight, is be in the bathroom with you. But the truth is I love that reality, because to me, fiction is a big giant lie that's trying to masquerade as the truth. That's all it is. I'm trying to convince you that everything I've made up is real. And to me, the best way to do that is to arm yourself with facts. So when you see, for instance, you'll see a scene in the White House private dining room that the president has, the family dining room. And I got that scene right because a couple years ago, I got invited to actually eat at the White House. And I got to go to a lunch there. And the best part was, I kept excusing myself every 3 minutes from the lunch, because all I was doing was trying to steal the napkins that have the White House logo on them. You know, every author when they go is like, I'm sorry, sir, I have to go to the bathroom again. And their pockets are out to here, you know. But I do have a lot of napkins. But what I saw there, I put in the book. And I wanted to know, you know, how do they tell you who sits next to the president? How do they tell you where you sit? Is it like my wedding? Are there cards with my name on it? What's it like? And you'll see in the novel, that's exactly how it is in real life. The best part was, is when you go and sit down in your seat, I was there, and Barbara Bush was there that day, and they sat me next to Barbara Bush. And there's a little card that does say my name and the White House on it. And I'm looking at the card, and I'm thinking to myself, I am completely stealing that. Right? I mean, it says the White House and Brad Meltzer on it. It is mine. And Barbara Bush sits down next to me. She goes, you know, all the novices and first-timers, they always want to steal their card. And I'm like, oh, yes, those novices and first-timers, you know. And then very quickly I was like, look, Thurgood Marshall, you know, and took it. And she totally, by the way, busted me for stealing my card. I was like, please don't tell on me. She's like, I will not tell on you. So she didn't tell on me. I was worried the Secret Service were going to kill me. And they didn't find the napkins either. I pulled that one, too. But those details you see, as I said, are real, and I love that part of the book. It makes it, to me, this hyper-reality. And I know that, again, you can make anything up, but I think that the world we live in today, we have more access to information than any other society in history. Now, the result of that is two things. One, we have more access to noise than any society in history, right? It's really hard now to find what's true. You can find a lot of information, but good luck on finding whether it's true, whether it's checked, because the worst thing that ever happened to our academic life is cut and paste. Because what happens is someone puts it on their website and someone copies it and pastes it somewhere else, and then it goes over and over and over, and you're 15,000 pages in Google before you see the one source from the Middle Ages that says that's not true. And no one really wants to cut and paste that, because the Middle Ages were crazy. They used to write F's as S's and all that. It was nonsense. So who trusts that? But to me, the other thing that happens as a result of all that information is we are a society that has the best BS meters of any society before us. And it's, you know, I can say that there are secret tunnels below the White House and they run all the way down to Disney World, right? And you do, you know, you what you're doing right now, which is, you know, you roll your eyes and smile. You know that that's nonsense. Something tells you that's nonsense. But if I tell you you're in the ground floor corridor and you'll see a little statue, a little bust of FDR, and between those two busts, walk in the little room, and you'll see chairs that are stacked up to the ceiling. That's where they store all the chairs for the state dinners. And on the opposite side of that room, go out that door. You'll smell flowers in the air. You're in the White House flower shop is right there. And suddenly you'll see the floor that start to slope downward. And the ceiling will slope downward. You'll see air conditioning ducts above your head. When you hit the dead end, make a right-hand turn, you'll see the metal door. That's the entrance to the bomb shelter, the real secret tunnel below the White House. Now you go, oh, my gosh, this is real. And you know it. I can't even tell you why, but we know. We know we're being lied to. We know we're, you know, it's how we smell politicians. It's how we smell fake celebrities. We know it. We just smell it. We smell it a mile away. And that is the result of our society. So for me, it is my crutch that I lean on. but it is one that I think, and I like when I read a book, that you get to see and something and learn something about what you're reading. So that's always where the inner circle starts. With that said, what I'd love to do is, rather than just keep telling you about the book, is answer questions. Because I've found, I was going to do a reading tonight, but I felt like, you know what, in the interest of your enjoyment, I felt like you all know how to read, right? Anyone who doesn't know how to read is not coming here tonight. And what I'd rather do is really get involved in the different things we work on, because people always wind up kept coming to me and asking me different questions. So if you can ask a question, you can ask about the novels, the comics, the TV show. You can ask about astrophysics. I write fiction. I'll make up an answer. And these nice people are going to help us, anyone who raises their hand, so that you can, yes, in the back there. If you can just wait to ask the question until you get the microphone.
Hello.
Hi there.
My cousin is Admiral Weatherburn, and my father is a corporal under his order administration for most of his life. I know what you're saying is actually true, because when I look at the books that my father obviously don't give out, like, we found all kinds of hidden tunnels, all kinds of nuclear silos and multi-nuclear warheads that people don't know about within the states and other countries. I actually know why we're going to war with all these countries, because of those reasons. And it is true, because I'm the son of the military. That's how come I know these secrets, even though I can't always prove it to them, because my father actually locks it up in the bank or locks it at the house. But we have all the evidence that what you're saying is absolutely true. Like, for me, because I'm a specific question, is that, what do you feel about this new situation with Pakistan right now?
Yeah, I think I'm totally qualified to speak about foreign relations. As a writer of fiction, I appreciate that. You sound like you have the most amazing family attic of all time, and I appreciate that too. I do, and I appreciate your family does serve in the military. I can tell you what I think about Pakistan, but I would be wasting your time. And the truth is what is happening. I will tell you about one thing that I do think about, and that is WikiLeaks, because it relates to that. And people always ask me, you know, what do you think about what's happening in other countries and what's happened with WikiLeaks? The one thing that I believe, you know, when they cull through all this information, they're not going to find great secrets that say, you know, this person is actually, you know, X, Y, or Z. That's not what the secret is. The secret is the information and how it got out itself. And when you tell a secret to one person and that secret is out in the world, you know that one person you told it to is a liar. And you know that they're working for someone else. And the result of WikiLeaks, as I talk to my people in national security, is it's going to be people you never see. That's who's going to disappear. People you'll never hear of, you'll never know their names. But they're going to realize that that piece of information came from this person, and that person's working for the United States, and that is no longer a good source for us. And that is no longer someone we trust. I mean, some of those people will escape, some of those people will get away, and some of those people will be killed for what they gave out. And that's going to be the result of it. Other questions that, yes?
How did you choose the host for Decoded?
Yeah, thank you. So the question is how do we choose the host for Decoded? Now, to be clear, the show, I don't know how many people have seen Decoded? Okay, so we have this show on History Channel called Brad Meltzer's Decoded, right? That's the greatest title of all time as far as I'm concerned. I said to my wife, honey, what are we having for Brad Meltzer's dinner tonight? Because yesterday we had Brad Meltzer's pasta, and tonight I'd like to have Brad Meltzer's chicken. And she said, you can go sleep on Brad Meltzer's couch. But, I mean, come on. It's called Brad Meltzer's Decoded. That's the most ridiculous title of all time. We love it. You know, I mean, they should make T-shirts of it as far as I'm concerned. And the question is, for those who don't know, this show is on the History Channel. It's on Thursday nights at 10 p.m. And every Thursday, what happened was a couple years ago, one of the heads of history read my novel, The Book of Fate. And The Book of Fate had Freemasons in it, and it had these Thomas Jefferson's old codes, and he said, we should do a show like The Book of Fate. And they came to me and said, we'll give you give us your 10 best mysteries throughout history, and we'll give you a team to solve them. And, you know, only a fool says no to that. And so we actually started putting together the team, and we selected the team by literally just going through casting tapes. I mean, all these tapes of all these people who put together these, you know, 6-minute tapes, and then you'd watch 10 seconds of it and judge and go on to the next one. And you think that sounds fun to, like, ooh, it'd be cool to do casting for your own television show. It's actually humbling and really humiliating, because you feel like you're back in sixth grade again, which is, to me, the last time I not so proudly judged people in 10 seconds and then had to move on. And it's really horrible, because you're like, you know, this person puts together this work, and you got 10 seconds to be like, nope, boring, next. But who we got in the end, Buddy Mack and Scott, who you see on each episode, are amazing. And they're the three researchers that I work with. They're my partners on the show. The show is set up like Charlie's Angels for nerds, for history nerds like myself. My wife is like, "You're Charlie." And I'm like, "I'm John Forsythe." She's like, "No, you're nerdier, but you're Charlie." And we get to go out there. We actually try to examine things. We did 1 week where we checked to see if there were satanic symbols built into the Statue of Liberty, which, of course, there are none. That's nonsense. But you will see what the Statue of Liberty is a symbol of, and I thought that was pretty incredible. We had an episode where we did whether John Wilkes Booth, 12 days after he shot Abraham Lincoln, whether he died, as it says in history books, or whether he lived for a longer time and escaped. And when that came to us, that came to me actually years ago, when one of John Wilkes Booth's, the lawyer who represents John Wilkes Booth's family, came to me and said, and when you write thrillers, you get the best crazy mail of all time. It's the best, right? Because I can tell you, my mail, especially since the show has aired, no one in America has received more photos of proof that Abraham Lincoln is gay than myself. Okay? Like, I have more if you think you have more photos of Abraham Lincoln being gay, I challenge you right now to a duel, because I have more photos than anyone that Abraham Lincoln is gay. Like, every day, 5 million people send me proof of, and proof, I'm not talking about just the words. I'm like, stop sending me this. I don't want, you know. It's fantastic. I love it. It's the best job in the world to get these photos every day. But what happened is John Wilkes Booth's family, the lawyers, comes to me and says, "We have reason to believe that John Wilkes Booth is not buried in his coffin. You want to hear our story?" Yes, I want to hear that story. That's a good story. And I rolled my eyes also, as I'm sure most people do, and said, come on, this is nonsense. There's no way he's not in there. I read, you know, Swanson's book, who's a buddy of mine who wrote Manhunt. It's one of the great books. To me, the pinnacle of research for the people who look at the escape and the manhunt after John Wilkes Booth, after Lincoln was killed. And I love that book. And there's no way he's dead. I know he was dead. And then this 90-year-old woman comes on the television show, and she says, "When I was a little girl, my family told me we had a secret. And the secret was that we were related to John Wilkes Booth, and that he escaped. He didn't die that night. He escaped and took on a new identity, and we could never tell anyone." And anyone who watched that episode went, "Oh my gosh, I don't know if she's telling the truth, but I know she thinks she's telling the truth. And man, we should at least do a DNA test and figure it out." And this woman had no gain, no financial gain. She wasn't trying to make a movie. She wasn't trying to do anything but tell her story. And that was so impressive to me, just to kind of hear that different side. And I love that every week we get to present those different sides. The fun part, people always say, "How come you don't tell us the truth, Brad? Just tell us who's in the coffin. I can tell you whatever you want to hear." But anyone who tells you they know is a liar. Because, you know, you can surmise who's in there. You can play Sherlock Holmes and you say, "Well, this is what I think." But until you do a DNA test, there's no way to know. And they told me when we first started the show, they said, on shows like this, if you do it poorly, they said, when you have less facts, you play more scary music. Right? No truer words, right? I mean, I was like, I never want to do that show. I never want to do the thing where we're trying to fear monger for people. And so, you know, when they first gave me the script, you know, I write all my own stuff in there. Like, the jokes that you see are all me trying to be funny, and I think I'm very funny, and they tell me I'm not very funny. And, but, you know, the very first week it came in and it said, "Brad," and it said, "Oh my gosh, the Illuminati have infiltrated the Freemasons, and I'm worried the team is in trouble." And I read it and I was like, what? I was like, one, I don't believe the Illuminati are in this show or even exist. The Freemasons are not trying to eat our babies, and the team's not in trouble. They got a whole camera crew around them. I'm sure they're fine. And then they said, well, what do you want to say? And I'm like, why don't we just try and tell the truth? And they were like, oh, yeah, that's interesting. And so I love that every week we get to present that, and we present it to people. We explore every week this different part of history, and you get to see the decision. You get to make the decision, because you get to see the two sides that are arguing. We try to show both sides, and I think it's pretty amazing. In fact, I brought something here for you tonight. If you watch Decoded, you might recognize me, especially the opening credits. And by the way, if you don't watch Decoded and you didn't raise your hand, I hate you, right? I mean, let me be very clear about that. And if we get canceled or if we don't get renewed, it's your fault. Take that from me as my gift to you, that guilt with you tonight. But I will tell you that one of the things I love about Decoded is if you see the opening credits especially or the commercials, you'll recognize me from such poses as this. And I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, he goes that side. Can he go to the other side? I go the other side. Sometimes I do this. And I know that looks like it's really easy. It's not. Okay? That is a challenge. It takes training. I have a stunt double who shows me how to pose. And to prove that, I mean, they literally hired someone to show me how to make my tough guy look. And don't try it at home. You will get hurt. I promise you that. So what I brought for you tonight, we're going to show it, is I actually brought footage from the filming of all the promos for Decoded so you can see my training in tough guy posing for television. So if we can lower the lights 1 second. You think I'm joking about this, too. I'm going to show you this, and they promised me the DVD would work. Okay, so here we go. I'm going to narrate us here. And this is actually from when we filmed all the commercials and all the promos for Decoded. That's not it. Okay, so here's Decoded. Here's the logo. It's a cool logo, right? Look at that, Brad Meltzer's. That's the best part right there. Okay, so now sometimes I look at you. I look at you, and then I say, I'm going to look off, and I'm going to look tougher. And I look off, and I look tougher. And then I say, you know what? I may look back at you. And when I look back at you, I love you. I love you. Now, this is what I call the chin. This move is called the chin. I invented that. And I say, you know what? That looked like a good one. I know you thought that was a good take. It wasn't, so I do another one. Now, sometimes I actually invent moves. I actually patent my own moves. I invented this move, and this move is called the pop-up. Boom, there it is. That's it. That's called the pop-up. I invented that. I trademarked it. Don't try it. Now, this is great. Okay. So sometimes I do the lean-in. I lean in. And anyone who... Now, this is such a hard and difficult move that when I'm done making this move, I'm sweating. I'm literally sweating. Look at this. Sweating. That is such a difficult move. It's so hard that I'm sweating again. It's such an incredible and difficult move. Now, here's my favorite part. This is actually the guy. Look what he's doing. He's showing me how to pose. He's showing me. And the sad part is... I follow him. I'm literally following this guy. Now, he thinks he's got all the moves. He doesn't realize in my arsenal that I have what I call the squat, right? And he also thinks I can only go on the left side. I go on the right side. Right now, he's off camera crying because he's like, I never even thought about going to the other side like Brad did. And can Brad do the squat on the other side? I can. I can. And then I go back just to show him up a little bit more. But this is pretty much my life right now, and that's Decoded. I will say that little thing you see, oh, there's the chin. One last time. That's for you. So don't try that at home. You will be injured. Yes, sir.
The Inner Circle's, from what I understand, the first book of a series. What made you decide to pick one character and write a series based on that character?
Yeah, the question is the Inner Circle, when you'll see, is the first time where I'm going to repeat these characters and have them come back. The first time I've ever tried a true series. And I will say that in every book I write, I bring back characters. I hide them. You never see them. Every book is a standalone. You can read them in any order. Doesn't matter. But I will always hide characters in the book. The bad guy in the 10th Justice, my first novel, is a guy named Rick. And his alias was named Mark Wexler. And if you're reading close enough when you read the second book, Dead Even, on one page, you'll see Jared, who's the lawyer in that book, is defending his client, who's named Mark Wexler. And if you happen to remember that from 10 years earlier, you'll see that Jared actually gets the villain of 10th Justice off. And that's what happens to him. Of course, my wife is like, you are the only idiot who's obsessive enough to care about this nonsense. But I love that. I love having little things in there if you do care enough to look. But this is the very first time where I'm bringing back the characters completely and telling the story. And the truth is, it's for one reason only. It's because I never tried it before. And the one thing I love to do, as anyone who has watched my almost silly kind of the way that my career goes, I love trying what I don't know if I can pull off. That is the best moment to me. The best moment is when you think you're about to fail and you don't know if you can do it, because that's the moment you feel truly alive. Like you leap from the trapeze, you have no idea if the other trapeze is there, and you certainly know that there's no net below you. But that to me is the best moment of all, because you may fail, but you may succeed. And I've done 8 books in a row now where I've written a new character every single time, and I just felt like, you know what, I don't know if I can pull off a series. I don't know if I can pull this off, but that's the exact perfect reason to try it. And that's how it keeps, for me, keeps it fresh and keeps it new every time. The thing that I'm most afraid of as an author is to be that guy who churns out the book year after year and you go, oh man, his first one was really good and then it went downhill and he's phoning them in. That terrifies me. And God bless the guys who can put them out every year. I can't. I put them out every 2.5 years because the research is so intensive for me. But to me, it's about quality and not quantity. And that's what I like. And so the only reason I'm doing it is just to really see if I can. If I fail, don't tell me. I want to think that I did a good job. Yeah, in the back over there. We just wait for the mic. Yeah, that's sure.
As far as making the these characters a series, did you decide to do that when you started the book or after you, I don't know, got acquainted with the characters?
Sure, very fair question. You know, the question of, you know, did you decide that midway or just at the end to make it a series? I actually decided way before I was writing. Because the thing about a book to me is every novel, you know, when you read the back of the book, it always tells you the plot. The plot's the least important part of the book to me. I always talk about the plot. When I told you about this book tonight, what did I describe to you? I described the plot to you. And again, that's the least important part because you know what the best plot is? Good character. That's the best plot, having a good character. And I knew that if I had to write a series, you can't just, you know, every book is about the character story arc. The biggest villain that every character fights in every one of my books is not the bad guy or the CIA or whoever the nonsense, you know, thing. It's they fight themselves. That's the greatest battle we will all fight, the fight within ourselves, the fight to accept ourselves for who we are. That's the best battle you'll ever have in your life. And to me, that's what every character is dealing with. But if I was going to do a series, it had to be a multifaceted character because I couldn't solve their problem in one book. It needed to be more. It needed to be someone complex enough. The fun part about Beecher to me is I think he's the most, in a strange way, like me on purpose. I think Ben Addison in my very first novel, my friends who read it, they all say, oh, that sounds like you and, you know, that's you. But that was me because I was young and I was idealistic and I was naive. And it was me without me trying or knowing because it was just pure instinct to write my first novel. Every first novel is just pure instinct. Nobody knows what they're doing. They just love and want to write and they just tear it up and race through it. And so I wasn't trying to be myself. It's just all I knew how to do. It was pure energy. But Beecher in this book is me on purpose. And I think he's very much me. He's terrified and he's brave and he's weak and sometimes he's strong and, you know, he likes to think of himself as funny and he's not. I mean, all the things I am. But what I love about Beecher is even what he's gotten into are things that I've just experienced in my own life. The way that the inner circle opens is you see Beecher encountering the very first girl he ever kissed on Facebook. She friends him on Facebook. And I think it's just a moment. I don't care, you know, we've all of America right now is going through this, whether it's via email or via Facebook, where someone from your past, from your high school, from your junior high school, has emailed you or friended you. And in that moment, I don't care what you do, I don't care how important you think you are, the moment that first kiss you ever got emails you, you are instantly transported back to your youth, right? All those emotions flood back like a tidal wave onto you. And I'm fascinated by that because what's happening right now in America is we used to deal with our past at high school reunions or on the holidays. That's when you went back to your room and you saw your old room and you'd feel like how you felt in high school again. But now we're confronted with our past every day. Every day your past is right there on Facebook, right there in email. And I love that. I actually love that. I think it's just it's an amazing thing to us. It makes us self-examine in a different way. And I love, you know, I couldn't crack Beecher, the character, until I said, you know, he's a character who's obsessed with the past. He lives in the past all day around these Abraham Lincoln letters and these Thomas Jefferson writings. And then he's confronted with his own past, his, you know, this old girl and his first kiss. And he can't even find his own future. He's so trapped in the past. And that's exactly where I was for the past 2 years of my life. As Facebook came, I will share this with you. Just don't tell her. I told you. So my very first kiss when I was in elementary school was Karen Aiken. And Karen Aiken was the girl I just, you know, I loved. She was just my first girlfriend, and she had freckles, and she was mean to me, and she was tougher than me, and so she was mean to me. I had to like her. And then there was this other girl, Ananda Breslov, and Ananda was sweet and nice, and I was like, oh, who should I like? Who should I like? And Ananda never would tell me she liked me, so I was, of course, too scared to like her. And I went with Karen because she was mean to me, and that was better. And as Facebook came around, I found all these old friends had found me through the books and through the website and through other things. And the only person I couldn't find was Karen Aiken and Ananda Breslov, right? My two little crushes from elementary school I couldn't find. And, you know, one day I'm on the computer and I tell my wife, I'm like, I'm going to find them tonight. She's like, will you stop? You are so pathetic. All right, you are so pathetic that you're looking for these two women. And I finally find her at like 11 o'clock at night. I find her phone number. She's like, do not call this poor woman at 11 o'clock at night to tell her, you know, like, what are you doing right now? And so one day, 2 years ago, as I was on book tour for The Book of Lies, I get a friend request from Karen Aiken. And I was like, call me up right now. And it was just this amazing moment. It was this visceral thing where we were right back and transported back to third grade. And then the best part of it is right after I heard from her, I went to a book signing in Chicago and Ananda Breslov came. And I said to Ananda, I said, you know, we caught up and she was just an amazing, both of them amazing women now. And I was, you know, I just admired my own taste because I still love strong women, right? I was like, I had good taste, even in third grade. I was like, I was a schlub. You know, I did have the lion's mane of hair, so that was working. But I was like, they're both strong women. And I married a strong woman, and my agent is a strong woman, and my editor is a strong woman, my publisher. It just keeps repeating. I just saw myself over and over. I have learned nothing in my age. It's still the same me. But the best part is Ananda Breslov says to me, when we were younger, this thing broke in my room and you broke it. And she was joking that I still owe her for it. And I said, well, what did I break? Did I break it on purpose or accident? She goes, no, on purpose. And I said, why did I break something in your room? She goes, you were mad at me. I said, why? And she said, because I wouldn't tell you if I liked you. And I said, well, of course I wanted to know if you liked me. And she said, dummy, of course I liked you. I said, I've waited 30 years for you to say those words. Right? I mean, I was just like, my whole life would be different today, and if you just told me. And my wife is like, you are truly the most pathetic man of all time. But I love the emotions it evokes in us. I love that it brings you back. I love that everything, your entire life gets erased in that moment, and then your future becomes rewritten right there. And that's what I wanted for Beecher. And so I had to really crack that character before I could start the book. Even though I had the plot, and even though I knew I could use the archives, and I knew I could use George Washington's firing, to have that character that was multidimensional and could stand up for all those other stories was vital. That was the most important part of the process.
I want to lead up my question with, I'm an American history nerd. In fact, that was what my degree was in.
Join the club, pal.
And I'm a huge comic book geek.
Join the club.
And I'm an amateur fiction writer, so you're my favorite person ever. So my question is going to be totally nerdy, and if anyone else hasn't read the book, no one's going to get it.
This is someone who says he's going to have the nerdiest question. Like, when you write comic books and have a show on the History Channel, that's like nerd. It's tough to beat nerd there, right? I mean, that's as nerd as it gets.
Fair enough.
I wear my underwear on the outside of my pants sometimes to be like Batman. Sometimes, not all the time.
In the Book of Lies, when you're doing the Superman mm-hmm. history there, you mentioned the attic copies. Was that a real thing?
That's actually an interesting question. Yeah, in the Book of Lies, I wrote a novel that was about that linked the biblical murder weapon that Cain used to kill Abel, and linked that with, of all things, Superman. The story of the greatest villain and the story of the greatest hero. And to me, I will backtrack and say, for those who don't know, I write comic books. And I love Superman. I love Batman. And I love them for the same reason that I love George Washington. George Washington and Superman are, in a strange way, the same to me. And I know one is fictional and one is real, but they are American mythology. That's what they are. And the reason their stories persist generation after generation, and the reason we love them generation after generation, is not just because they're interesting. It's because those characters, those heroes, tell us who we can be. They show us our potential. Both of them do. And when I wrote the book, there was this moment in about attic copies where you found original Action Comics number 1 when Superman was created. I actually made up the idea of the attic copy, but I will say that I made it up based on a real visit. I went to the house where Superman was created. It's in Cleveland, Ohio, and I walked in, and I expected it to look like something out of a Norman Rockwell painting, that there was hot apple pie steaming right on the front porch waiting just for me, and it was a mess. It was wrecked, devastated. And there were holes in the walls and holes in the ceilings. And the people who lived there, this real nice couple, came out and said, and it's a rough neighborhood now. And they came out and said, you know that Cleveland won't even give us a plaque to say that Superman was created here, not even a plaque. And I said to her, I'm going to get you your plaque. And I said, I'm going to be back. And I had no idea what I meant. It was just a macho thing to say at the moment. I was like, I'll be back. You know, that was all I had. But I did what I always do. The only thing I ever know how to do is I told the story. I started sharing that story about the house with people. And people from the comic book industry started donating artwork, and David Letterman donated something, and Stephen Colbert's staff donated something, and we had this auction to raise money for the house, and we raised over $100,000 to, you know, the house where Google was founded is protected. The garage where Hewlett-Packard is founded is also protected, but the house where Superman was created was a wreck and had snow and water coming in. So we actually have repaired the house. I'll tell you that part about it. And I just recently, over the holidays, got a Christmas card from the couple that lives there and said, thank you, this was the first year there wasn't water in our house during the holidays. Merry Christmas. Which was amazing because I owe all the people here who helped with that. It was all the people who love comics, in the same way that we do, did it. But the attic copies I did make up. But I will tell you that you just saw there was a story about 4 months ago of someone who found a copy in their attic, and I'm still determined. The nice part was Jerry Siegel's wife was very helpful. She gave me the idea for it because she told me about a flood in Jerry Siegel's house one day where he ran down and went to save all of his stuff. And I just kept thinking, what did he have? What did the guy who created, you know, Superman was created by two 17-year-old poor kids in Cleveland. I love that, right? Two 17-year-old kids who were so poor they used to draw on the back of wallpaper gave us Superman. And so, needless to say, I had to write an entire novel about that. Yeah, let's get, we can get you a microphone. Hold on one sec.
Hi. Do you have any comic work planned? And if you could work with any artist of your choice who you haven't already worked with, who would it be?
Yeah, question is a new comic book work. I just finished Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which was really fun. And Joss Whedon had asked me to do that, and I couldn't say no to that. So that just came out. Until then, I actually don't have any new comic book work planned. I'm still talking to everyone and just kind of trying to find the time. But if I could probably work with anybody in comics right now, someone that I spoke to that I'd love, I mean, Jim Lee knows I'd love to do something, and, you know, he's just one of the nicest guys around, so I'd probably pick him today. I mean, maybe John Cassaday, maybe Brian Hitch, the usual suspects, or Frank Quitely. I think Frank Quitely pretty much is maybe the best out there, but, you know, beside Jim, I think, you know, Jim and Frank are neck and neck for me. So those are pretty, otherwise I pretty much have checked my boxes. The best part is when you write comic books, you, the artist will sometimes let you keep the art or buy the art. So every time I get paid to write a comic book, all the money goes back to buy the art. So it's like the most losing proposition ever, but I have all this really geeky artwork that my kids hate.
Well, I guess just following with that, is there any character specifically that you would like to work on that maybe you haven't or just like to work on again?
Yeah, my favorite character of all time, and I will say it over and over, is Batman. And I've loved, if you look at any picture of me from when I'm 6 years old to about 36 years old, I'm wearing a Batman cape in it. And, you know, because, and you know why I love Batman? Because I'll never be Superman. I will never have lasers that come out of my eye. I'll never fly. I'll never be able to lift a car over my head. But I can be Batman. Batman's just a stubborn guy. That's all he is. I could be that. And it was possible to me. Even in my six-year-old brain, I understood that. So that's the character I'd always come back to. But I'd love to do the X-Men. I'd love to do the Avengers. Those are characters. These are the as I said, the American mythology. And to be able to put even one little square on that beautiful quilt that gets knit every week in their adventures is amazing. I mean, I love writing the novels. I love doing the television show. But when I get to sit at my desk and write Superman, and I get to put words in Superman's mouth, that's an awesome day at work, right? That is just a part of history, and there's nothing like it, especially when you hear from Jerry Siegel's family that they appreciate something that you put in one of the books. I mean, it's as humbling as can be. But I'd take a crack at any of those characters. Yeah.
I'm actually also a big Batman fan, and more than that, a big Robin fan.
I love that the comic
fan.
Book guys are screwing you guys to nobody's business. I love that. That's the best part of it.
I'm a big Robin fan more than anything, because I have a firm belief that there can be no human aspect of Batman without Robin being there.
Yeah.
Identity Crisis also is my favorite comic of all time.
Thank you. I appreciate
strictly
it.
Being because I grew up without my father being in my life, and Robin losing his father is kind of a key sure. point of Tim Drake. Where did you get the idea for that story plot? Did that come more from DC or
yeah.
from you?
Yeah, the question is, we did a book a couple years ago, and this is actually really interesting, Identity Crisis, there it is. And Identity Crisis, of all things, came out of 9/11, amazingly. And what happened was, is when 9/11 happened, remember those moments after 9/11 happened when you'd be in the airport or you'd be walking down the street and you'd see a police officer or someone in the fire department and you'd say, thank you. See a member of the military, thank you. We all had that moment where we'd look at them and realize, you know, up until that moment, they were just people who, you know, you saw, again, out of a Norman Rockwell picture. You know, there was the fireman who had the kid on his shoulder and that's what they did. And then after 9/11 happened, you said, wait, people in the fire department risk their lives every day. Every day they can die when they put on that uniform. And DC Comics came to me and said, Brad, we'd love you to do a story. And they call it, it was supposed to be a small emotional story. That was all we had planned on. And they said, we want that feeling. You know, it used to be that we felt that about firemen, and then now we feel like they could die every day. We want that feeling for our heroes, for Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman of all things. They said, we want that feeling that when they put on their costume, you know, even though it has a cape and a utility belt, but when they put on their uniform, we've lost the feeling that they can die. I want to bring that feeling back. And that was pretty much the assignment. It was as open-ended as that, and then I had to kind of solve it. And I don't want to ruin the ending, but once I had the ending and I knew who benefits, I said, I got the story. I got it. And I said, I got it. And at first I said, no, I can't do it. And they called me back and I said, let me think on it some more. I was on the phone with Mike Carlin and I said, I got it. And then I went in and pitched the entire story. And the fact that it's been able to have the ramifications it's had, again, is it's unbelievable to me. And it's one of the things I'm most proud of ever working on. And Rags Morales, who's from Philadelphia, is one of the nicest guys in the whole world, who was the artist on the book, and one of the most amazing guys around. And he's, you know, one of the sons of your city, and lucky to have him. So Identity Crisis always holds this little part of my heart. Other questions I saw? Yeah. Please be another comic one.
Well, it could be. I'm a big comic fan, but I'll switch over to...
Okay, I appreciate it. They're in the back, they're like... Whoosh.
For Decoded, was that a one-shot deal, or will there be another season?
Yeah, the most important question of the night, is there going to be any more Decoded? I mean, that's all I care about, right? I don't care about anything else. The truth is, I have no idea. We've been thrilled with the ratings. They've been thrilled with the ratings. The response has been crazy. And never did we expect the response we got for it. And I think people really do appreciate that we're not trying, as I said, to fearmonger out there. We're really just trying to tell amazing stories in American history. And the best part is people keep saying, why did you just do America? This is just fascinating to me. And I didn't know this until we started the show, because I pitched them all these different ideas of things we should do. You know, and I had this thing at the Vatican, and we could do this, and we can do this, and, you know, and do the Nazis in Germany in World War II. And they said, we can't do that. And I was like, why? Is it a cover-up? Is the Vatican hiding something? What's happening? And they said, no, dummy, you have a first-season show. We're not paying for everyone to go to Europe. And it was just budget. It was nothing more than budget. That's all it was. And I was like, damn, my whole plan to get a free trip to Italy is totally ruined, which was really the only reason I pitched them that idea. But we have two more episodes to air. We have a great episode tomorrow night. And the worst part is on Thursday night, I should say, last Thursday, they scheduled an event at the same time as Decoded. And I was like, that's the stupidest idea of all time. Like, that's our viewers right there. But it was a great episode, because what it was is we did George Washington's spy ring. And in fact, where are you? There he is. Will you please stand up? You're going to see him from the episode, one of the stars of that episode, from your city of Philadelphia, one of our experts on the show. And this is John Nagy. You might recognize him from such moments as this. He also had a pose off with me. He crushed me. He was unbelievable. But thanks to John for being on the show. But we did this episode on George Washington's spy ring. You saw the invisible ink. You saw the secret codes that Washington used to use. And the best part of the whole episode was they actually featured the Inner Circle on the episode, which got it on television and made it the most gratuitous hour of television of all time. My publisher was thrilled. Although I will tell you, this is the best joke in the whole show that they cut. There's this moment on the show. The show, for those who watch, is sponsored by Porsche. And I talked about, you know, because the show had the product placement of the novel, I looked at the camera and I said, listen, I just want to tell you right now, I promise you there'll be no more product placement in this episode, except, of course, for the giant Porsche that we're driving around in. And everyone thought that was a really funny joke, but what the best part of the joke was, they cut, is they pull out after I say that, and what you can't see is when they pull out, I'm actually reading a copy of my own novel, The Inner Circle. And then I look down and I go, oh, Meltzer, you've done it again. And I was like, that's the funniest joke ever. And they're like, that is not the funniest joke ever. And so they cut it away. But I have no idea what, you know, the fun part is they're letting me have a good time with it. This week's episode is actually at Bohemian Grove. And the Grove is this amazing, great secret society that exists out in California, where many presidents have been to, and most powerful men in the world. And that's usually a cliche when you say the most powerful men in the world are there. But it's true, because they don't allow any women in. And I will tell you that parts of the team get arrested this week, making it the greatest hour of television we've done. And you'll see exactly why they get arrested when you watch the episode. And you'll see what happens when Buddy goes to jail, which is fantastic to me, because he came home safe. Yep, one more. Okay, they said one more question. Yes, would you like to ask, ma'am?
I was on your John Wilkes Booth episode.
You were on our John Wilkes Booth episode. You were. We have the entire cast of Decoded here tonight. Anyone who's ever been on the show, thank you. I appreciate it.
But you know what? And your people were great. And from the first email all the way through, your people, Rob and Peter Berg and everybody, you have a great crew.
Yeah,
we do. I want you to pass that along.
I appreciate that. Yeah. No, anyone who wants to be on the show, we'll put you in too. We don't care anymore. No. But seriously, we got the nicest experts. We went out to get the best people. And of course, it's no surprise if you're doing a story, a show on history, that it's here. Now, let me end by saying this, just a couple quick things. One is when we set out on this book tour, I said to my editor, you know, when you go to the Rolling Stones and you get like a concert T-shirt and you're all psyched because you have something to kind of remember the night, and why don't they have? We should make a book tour rock concert T-shirt. And she said, that's the stupidest idea I've ever heard. And I was like, no, that's a good idea. And I went actually to the Decoded art department and the guys in Hollywood who are just amazing. And I said, can you do a shirt for me? And so I'm unveiling tonight, you'll see, for the very first time ever, this is the first ever book tour rock concert T-shirt complete with George Washington's flaming head skull. Sure, you see the George Washington? Now, the best part of this shirt is not only does it have it on the front, the Inner Circle Tour, but all the tour dates, including Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in the back. It is also the only rock concert T-shirt that also has Boca Raton, Florida, right? I mean, this is like the most Jewish shirt of all time. You could actually wear this to Passover. It's fine. It's totally fine. But, you know, we love that. But I will tell you, we're selling the shirts outside. We only have a couple left because they've been selling out everywhere. They're only $20. We make no money from the shirts. We don't make a single dollar of profit. All the profits go to City Year. And I know Philadelphia knows City Year very well. But for those who don't know, City Year is a nonprofit group. There's City Year Philadelphia, there's City Year New York, there's City Year Boston. My wife and I and Wendy Spencer brought City Year to Miami. And it is an amazing program that brings kids who are 17 to 24 years old and lets them mentor in our schools. It's like a Peace Corps for the United States. And so all the profits go to City Year. So we'd love if you can help us support City Year. Other quick piece of business is I pre-signed a couple books. So anyone who doesn't want to wait, you can grab the pre-signed ones. And I thank you for coming. And then let me end with this. And that is, as I said at the beginning, this is a book that's about history. And I so appreciate the history that I have with this city from start to finish. But what I do believe when I look at history is not a bunch of dates and facts that are memorized from a textbook. History is this living, breathing thing that changes every single day. And that's what I love about it. History is a selection process. And it doesn't just choose a moment and a person and put them together. History chooses every single one of us every single day. And so when you have that moment, the only question is do you hear the call? And I know that there are a lot better ways to spend your Tuesday night, especially when the President of the United States is speaking and you can instead choose the little bald guy. And I appreciate you doing that tonight. It means more. You know, I find words for a living, and I can't express how much I appreciate your support in the comics, in the TV show, in the novels, and in any other crazy thing we do, including the nonfiction books. It means, as I said, everything. So thank you for coming out tonight. I greatly appreciate it, and I'll be signing books outside. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.